Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mugs at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 9th of August and this is episode 72. We got a huge show for you guys coming
absolutely
up.
Massive.
Sorry. Absolutely massive. We are going to be talking to the editor of Spiked. A lot of you people out there are going to be familiar with that one. It's a British online magazine. Brendan O'Neill we're going to be speaking to. Really cool interview. We're going to be talking about Brexit, the divide between the elites and the public over in Britain, over Brexit, over a whole bunch of issues, the growing intolerance of the left towards new ideas, whole range of issues. Really interesting chat.
30 minutes.
Yes. But the best person on this podcast this week, Pete. Welcome back, Nina. We missed you last week.
You feeling better? Yes, I'm feeling better. Thank you, guys. Sorry I missed it.
Well, we were absolutely adrift without you.
Absolutely. Like at one point, at one point I realized like halfway through me and Pete doing our bit, I was just like, I haven't even looked at this sound for the last 5 minutes. Yeah. Like none of this could be recording. Like none of it could be registered. I wouldn't know.
We actually did the show 6 times and forgot to record at the first 5.
That third one was so good.
Oh,
would have been brilliant. Cool. So let's get into it. So pretty big week of stories. So we've got a whole lot to cover here.
Yeah.
So if I may lead off, Pete.
Kick us off, James.
Okay, because I know we're going to be getting to what you think should be the biggest story in the world, but it's not the biggest story in the podcast.
It is the biggest story in the galaxy.
Okay, but we'll start with this one. So Jacinta Allen versus Sky News seems to be the biggest issue in Victoria for the last few days, and it's getting out into the national staff. News.com.au, you were going nuts with it. So bit of background here, if you guys have missed out. So Sky News, they dogged it this week. They had noted far-right activist Blair Cottrell on the network. It doesn't seem to be like a station-wide decision, like everyone huddled in, you know, no. Paul Murray, they're all there going, like, we should get him on. It was basically one show. He was on for a little bit.
Adam Joel's show.
Yeah, Blair Cottrell, nasty guy, nasty piece of work.
United Patriot front leader.
That's very good. That's some research. Very good, Pete. They had him on for an interview and, you know, there was like a day of like, how could Sky do this? And yeah, the presenter, I think, is like on leave or something like that.
Not sure.
Anyway, so it wasn't good. Sort of went away, and then Jacinta Allen, the Victorian Transport Minister, decided to bring it back. She tweeted out, I've directed Metro Trains, which is the Victorian Trains Authority over here, to remove Sky News Australia from all CBD screens. Hatred and racism have no place on our screens or in our community. So for people interstate, like basically in the CBD, in the main train stations we got here in Melbourne, if you go down, you'll be a screen and you can see like Sky News, and it's just like news and weather updates around Melbourne. So Sky's gone from that.
Yep.
And Jacinta Allen's idea was that somehow the Blair Cottrell interview have been put on the train stations, which isn't true. It's just basically news and like not even the big Sky shows get on the train stations. It's just a straight rundown of news and weather.
News and sport package.
Yeah, basically. And that was, so she's gone, no more Sky on trains.
Yeah.
So shameless.
Well, yeah. Firstly, fix the trains.
Fix the trains. Like that would be my number one thing.
You're the transport minister. Yep. I have to stand at Brunswick Station every morning for 400 hours because the trains are late.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's like, why do you get to decide what we watch?
Yeah, absolutely. And the second thing is like, there is absolutely no way this was 100% to do with the interview. This is a political football. It's just Sky's down.
Yeah.
Let's kick him.
Because Sky bags, obviously, the Victorian government all the time.
Exactly. And the other thing is, so Blair Cottrell, nasty piece of work, but he's also been on ABC, Channel 7 and Channel 9. Yeah. So
I did not know that.
Yeah. So over the last few months or so, he pops up his head every now and then, you know, talking about Islam on ABC, stuff like that. None of those stations get pilloried or removed from anything. So.
Well, surely that means the ABC should be removed from any television because race and hate has no place in there.
Not in our community, Pete. Not in our community. So this led to one of the all-time train wreck interviews I've seen.
Oh,
do you absolutely know, brilliant.
That's a good pun.
All-time. Oh, right. Yeah. Good. Yeah, I meant that.
Which I wrote yesterday in hay and meant.
And I missed it then and I missed it now. I think we just have to play it. So David Spears and Laura Jays, they are laying into Jacinta Allen on the show, just saying you do realise that no one saw it on a train. But we'll play it.
I just wanted to establish a couple of facts here, if we can. Are you aware that the product people are watching now, the Sky News product, is not actually what goes to air on any of the train platforms in Australia or on Qantas planes? Are you aware that it is specifically a tailored news, sport, weather service? Are you aware of the difference there?
Yes.
You said in your remarks earlier you believe the Blair Cottrell interview was screened on the Metro platforms. In fact, you said that interview was not only shown, it was on repeat rotation. Who told you that?
No, David, and now I'll be very clear of the comments I made earlier. I did give an indication that I believe that excerpts were run of that interview, and that the reference to repeat rotation is that the material, the Sky News material, I wasn't referring to that specific interview, I was referring to the material more generally, is run on repeat rotation.
Well, you were asked specifically about the Blair Cottrell interview, Minister, with respect. You were asked at your press conference specifically about the Blair Cottrell interview, and you said it was. We have checked the tapes of what was sent to the Metro service. It was not shown. You can see that?
Well, as I indicated in my comments this morning, the advice I had was that it had been screened. You've obviously gone and done a lot of checking on this afternoon, and I will go and check the advice that you have.
A lot to come out of that one. So good.
Yeah.
My personal favourite, if I may, is when she says yes, and they weren't expecting a one-word response, so everyone's mics were down. So there's like a one. If you listen back, you can hear it. You can hear David Spear's microphone increase because everyone's panicking.
Yeah.
And the second one is Jacinda Allen saying you've certainly done a whole lot of checking this afternoon. Yeah. It's like, you reckon? You just called us Nazis. Like, I'm going to follow up on what happened there.
It's just, why didn't you do any checking?
Yeah. What, you just like tweeted that, done. All right, move on with the day. What else is
on? You banned a television station for 150,000 commuters.
Yeah.
Without checking.
Absolutely. Being grilled by David Spears, by the way, got to be one of the scariest things in the world. Like, you could not pay me to get grilled by David Spears on anything.
Well, it hasn't happened
any
to me
aspect
for a while,
of my life.
Yeah, look, I'll take that on board.
Okay, cool. Do we want to move on?
Yes, let's move on. So Jacinta Allen doing that is a pretty big story. But
if I can say, though, I would, like, the Sky being removed from train stations, it is a hell of a thing to be waiting for the last train at this train station, and then a promo for your dad's show just comes on, and it's like late at night. You're a bit like, oof.
It's your dad telling you off for being out so late. Yeah, what have you been doing for the last 4 hours, James?
I'm uncomfortable right now.
Anyway,
it's like 28 minutes at the next train station. That promo is going to be running a fair few times.
Yeah, I hate it when that happens to me. Yes. So the biggest story in the world this week should be.
Okay.
Unemployment. The US economic recovery rolls on. Unemployment figures in the US came out last Friday. 3.9% was the July figure. Not quite the 18-year low of May, which was 3.8%, but still pretty good. 4.8% was the unemployment rate when the current administration was inaugurated in January 2017. Now, here's an interesting stat for you, James, which I found by doing research. The average unemployment rate in the US between 1948 and 2018 was 5.77%, so well below that. As I said, this should be the biggest story in the world, not racist nerds at New York Times, which we'll get onto a bit later.
Or the fact that Trump tweeted that he preferred MJ to LeBron, which got a whole lot of play this week.
Did it? Yeah, that's right.
So, did you consider that?
I actually didn't consider that. This is one of the biggest stories in the world. But what I love about this, right, the social justice aspect. We talk about the best way to help poor people, the best way to help struggling communities in the world is economic growth, and the best way to promote economic growth is obviously cutting taxes and red tape and other things. Record lows were registered for Hispanics, 4.5%, and high school dropouts, 5.1%. In the most recent figures, African American unemployment hit a record low in May of 5.9%, and female unemployment hit its lowest point since 1953 in May, 3.6%. Now, obviously, there's a range of factors contributing to this, but cutting taxes and red tape certainly helps, James.
Absolutely. I just don't see Jim Acosta reporting that one anytime soon, nah, so hopefully
sir,
it makes its way.
Sir, resign, sir.
Trump has actually broken that man's brain. Yeah. Like, there's nothing. Like,
he's lost it.
There is just the duck going into the water inside his brain.
Yeah.
Just sir, resign.
I should point out that this situation would be better if there was more free trade. Obviously, on Tuesday, the US announced that they would impose a 25% tariff on another $16 billion worth of Chinese goods starting August 23. This is their second round of tariffs that the Trump administration has brought in. An earlier tranche came through in July worth $34 billion worth of Chinese imports.
Yeah, so it's getting better. It could be so much better, but we're on the right path.
Yep.
Yep.
That's the takeout.
Not that good takeout. That's some good takeout. Cool. So another story we wanted to talk about. This one, another free speech issue. So Alex Jones a lot of people know who that guy is. You've probably seen him scream or yell or do some sort of removing of the shirt on a political issue.
When are we going to do that?
I'll need a few more push-ups before I'm confident. That's for later. So Alex Jones, conspiracy theorist, not a great guy, currently being sued for libel for saying that Sandy Hook was a false flag operation, I think, and they were all crisis actors. So, you know, nasty piece of work. And he's got a pretty big following based off just all the conspiracy stuff. And I swear there's a whole lot of people who are just there for the memes. But he this week got banned. He had his Facebook page taken off, his YouTube channel taken down. He's off Spotify and his podcast was removed from Apple. So all of these tech giants, they just got together. Well, we don't know they got together, but quite simultaneously, all of his stuff starts disappearing from the internet.
Within a few hours, really.
Yeah, so it's not really a free speech issue because Alex Jones can still say what he wants, like on any other platform, or he can walk down the street and just start spouting his nonsense. But
yeah, and they're private corporations.
Yeah, and they're private corporations. You don't have a right to a YouTube channel. But it's still a little concerning that a tech giants can just get together and just purge someone like that.
Yeah, it's not great. And as Brendan O'Neill said in an article, and that was... what did he say? He said that, you know, it's weird that liberals' new favorite thing is corporate censorship.
Yeah, like the left using corporate censorship, they say, they go straight to the providers.
These capitalist icons deciding what we can think and say. And
yeah, and it's one of those weird ones because there's no solution that I'd be comfortable with.
Like, what do you mean?
Well, it's in like, you can't, like, the idea that, I don't like that tech giants can just purge someone from the internet. But I don't think the government should be able to stop tech giants from doing that. That's even scarier to me.
Well, you just think that, you know, social media that's not the main players at the moment will rise up and
over that. Well, that was one of the takeaways. I mean, you could have seen this coming from a mile away. But when I say that Alex Jones's podcast was removed from Apple, the Alex Jones InfoWars, which is his company, the app is still on the App Store.
Yep.
And that got up to number 3 in the most popular downloaded charts.
Well,
like, if you want to give this guy breathing space, you remove him, you make him a story. Like, now he's got, I'm onto something, they want to see me go away.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, if you're a conspiracy theorist, this is great. And also, I will point out, are these corporations going to give back all the money they've made out of Alex Jones over the last few years?
Yeah, exactly. Turn in your yachts.
Because if they're dinkum, show me the money.
Show Pete the money. Give Pete the money.
Show me in particular.
Give Pete the money. If you don't want the money, Pete will take the money.
Yeah. And don't give yourself Spotify, please. Thanks.
Yes, please. Or iTunes. Also, one thing I want to say is, so right now it's like, look, I'm not going to die on the hill of Alex Jones. Like, I'm concerned. I don't like it, but I'm not going to die on Alex Jones' hill. But if they take my Alex Jones memes, which I'm not sure if they're going to or not, then I'm riding. Because I don't know if you guys have heard this one, but Alex Jones apologizing for his outbursts might be the best video on YouTube.
But I will stomp your head in if you start a fight with me, you thug scum. Anyways, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Bunch of cowards. Excuse me. I'm gonna control myself right now. She is a demon damned to hell. Excuse me.
Well, you know, it takes a big man to apologize after you've made a mistake.
Yeah, well, you know, he backed down, so play on. Let's talk National Geographic.
Okay, well, there was a couple of really venerated cultural institutions.
Okay,
in
college
our...
boy. Yeah, venerated, are they?
Venerated's a word. Look it up if you don't know what it means. But the so a couple of really big magazines, The Economist and National Geographic. The Economist, of course, got burned. That's another pun, which will make sense in a second because it's about bushfires.
There we go. Yeah. I was like, what?
Got burned by Bjorn Lomborg, IPA guest, who tweeted, please stop the misleading fire stories. The US is smouldering less, not more. 2018 will likely see burnt area 1/6 of the US record. So, and then he tweets this image of The Economist, which has got this front cover, which says, you know, in the line of fire, losing the war against climate change, Earth is smouldering from Seattle to Siberia. And then next to that, Bjorn Lomborg's created this graph, which shows that the damage done by wildfires in the United States between 1926 and 2018 has been drastically reduced. And that was sort of catching The Economist out a little bit. He said in his Facebook post, you know, he reckons climate change is accelerating bushfires and making bushfires worse, but because we've got more advanced firefighting methods, the damage is actually less, right? So he's not even denying that it's a thing. He's just saying that, you know, innovation and technology is making it better, which is true.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and then you got the National Geographic one where the... You guys might have seen that, like, the video of the polar bear that was, like, starving. And
well, you probably have.
Yeah, because...
It reached 2.5 billion people.
So, the National Geographic says. So, that was like a famous one of like, this is the effects of climate change in real time. And then National Geographic ran a story by the photographer Christina Mittermeier, who said that we probably jumped the gun. Well, she didn't say that it was like, she didn't want it to be the climate change story. She just said, how sad is that polar bear? And she started filming it and was sad. But National Geographic said, like, this is what climate change looks like. And now they're sort of saying, well, you know, we can't actually say why that polar bear was starving. Like,
yeah,
it might have been a million things. Yeah. So, yeah, there was like the golden period back in 2012 where you could write any alarmist climate change article, international headlines.
The golden period.
Like,
no,
yeah, it was like the golden age of alarmists. Yeah. You could write anything and no one would take you up on task. And now it's like, you kind of need to justify that. Like, if you're going to say the US is burning, someone's going to come at you.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. Well, you know, we sort of one side gets organised, so the other side gets organised. That's how politics works, James.
Oh, thank you, Pete.
But it actually went for a few years before then as well. But the thing about this for me, right, like, so National Geographic is claiming we should be looking after wildlife. Yet they would exploit a dying polar bear for money.
Yeah.
So apparently they found this polar bear like 2 days before they filmed it. And they're like, oh my God, this polar bear's dying. Called in recording equipment and staff to film it and then made heaps of money out of it.
Oh, that's pure evil.
Well, you know.
that's not great.
Anyway.
All right, cool. So last story, and this would have been really cool to talk to with Brendan O'Neill about because it's exactly what we're talking about. So we won't spend too much time on it, but like, Candace Owens, pretty influential commentator at the moment. Kanye West tweeted out like she really liked. Kanye really liked what she was talking about. Yeah. Made her a bit of a celebrity. She was just having breakfast with Charlie Kirk, I think his name is, from Turning Point USA. But basically, two pretty conservative heroes. And then Antifa show up and they just start chanting. And apparently, you just can't have breakfast anymore in the US.
Yeah,
yeah, pretty sad.
Like, it was terrible.
Yeah, I at this point I would play the audio, but it actually bums me out whenever I listen to it, so I don't really want to.
Yeah, it's pretty...
Because I don't want to make our listeners sad.
Yeah.
I care about our listeners.
When you sent it through me the other day, I felt sad.
Yeah, so, well, I'll just like... There's two things I want to take away from you. One of the chants they do is 1, 2, 3, F the bourgeoisie, and you can fill in what F is there. And then they go 4, 5, 6, F the bourgeoisie. That's... That doesn't rhyme. It's not original. Work on your chants, people.
Yeah.
That's freezing in the moment.
Protest chants have been crap for a while.
That's pretty bad.
In the 60s, they would have been
changing a little bit.
But yeah, and it doesn't rhyme either time.
Yeah.
I mean, bourgeoisie rhymes with bourgeoisie, I suppose.
Well, 1, 2, 3, bourgeoisie.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true.
And then 4, 5, 6, bourgeoisie.
Yeah, I mean.
that's just terrible.
That's not it, is it?
Yeah. And then like the chanting F white supremacy.
Yeah.
At Candace Owens.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's black.
African-American for those people who don't know who she is.
So basically, if you watch this footage and you don't know anything that's happening, it's just a whole bunch of white people screaming at a black woman for trying to have breakfast.
Kicking out of a restaurant.
Yeah.
Gee, what does that remind me of?
It's like Alabama in the 40s, maybe? Yeah. And then just like, they're actually screaming at her face to stop her from talking. Like, not even words at this point, just like screaming and blowing whistles. It's
so bad.
It's really bad.
They literally hate her more because of the color of her skin.
100%.
It's like, because she's African-American, she upsets the narrative.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So they hate her. So literally, so a young black woman has the temerity to actually express an opinion.
Yeah.
And she gets shouted down.
Yeah, and if you think
by the people who say everyone's racist and everyone... Yeah, everyone's racist.
Exactly. And she's having breakfast with Charlie Kirk, who's white, and they're not going at Charlie Kirk as much as they're going at Candace Owens.
Exactly.
So just use that as the example. Like, one of them's a black woman, one of them's a white guy. Who's getting more copping? Who's copping more from that one?
Well, it's a strange world that we live in, James.
Anywho, so let us get on to the...
Patina Arndt?
Oh, yes. Sorry.
More story. Very quickly, we told you last week about Patina Arndt got banned from speaking at La Trobe University.
Yeah, if you want to hear more about that, go back to the Lesh interview from last week.
Yes,
That's what we were talking about.
Yep, and then what happened was they said you can come, but you have to pay for security, and they weren't going to pay for counselling that they were providing for students that might be offended by her speech. Anyway, that's weird. And then eventually, after Matthew Lesh made comments in the media about it, they said, okay, we're not going to make you pay security costs. So excellent impact from Matthew and, of course, our Generation Liberty students out there who were involved in that.
Okay, let's run through what the IPA got up to this week. So we've got three op-eds on our website you guys can read. John Roskam, Executive Director here at the IPA this morning, wrote an article in the Australian Financial Review talking about government snooping will not stop at the banks. So you guys might have seen like one of the things coming out of this inquiry is that each bank is going to have like someone there working for the government spying on them. And, you know, it's not going to stop at the banks. Like something is going to be put out. The same principle is going to be put out elsewhere.
Centre-right think tanks.
Yeah, exactly. So John is going to be talking about that issue at the Australian Financial Review. Make sure you read that. We've got Matthew Lesh in The Spectator. So as Pete was just talking about with Patina Arndt, Matthew sums up that issue and talks about some of the issues that are coming out of that. And we also got Morgan Begg, great friend of the podcast, industry super funding of union movement in the spotlight. So that was a media release we put out when that was announced. You can go read that. Over on our Facebook page, we've got Matthew Lesh talking about the plastic bag ban. We've also got Gideon talking about the plastic bag ban. This thing will not go away as an issue. So if you do want to hear a few more facts, like some really cool stats came out of those, so make sure you go over to our Facebook page and you can arm yourself with some statistics about that. That was a difficult word to say. And also...
it is hard.
Yeah, statistics. Yeah. And then you've also got Simon Breeny was on ABC News and they were talking about the farmers' drought in Australia. And Simon said, well, if we really want to help farmers, let's lower electricity prices and stop going after all these Paris agreements, which will help.
And of course, check out the IPA on Instagram.
Yes. IPA is now on Instagram, so go follow us there. Whole lot of cool things run by Henry Travers. Cool. And then speaking of announcements, so... If you're a member of the IPA, you would have received an email from me or a few emails from me over the last few weeks talking about the IPA's new podcast, the Great Books of Literature podcast. This is going to be John Roscombe, executive director here at the IPA, and Andrew Bolt, the Sky News commentator slash dad. They are going to be going through the 10 great books that they see of literature, list that they've created. They're going to be talking about the books. They're going to be sending in questions. So make sure you download that. It's coming out on Tuesday next week. It's going to be available on iTunes, Spotify, and through the website. So make sure you guys subscribe to that. Get excited. It's going to be really good. The first one we're talking about is going to be Bleak House by Charles Dickens. All right. So we'll go to an interview with Brendan O'Neill now. But before we do, thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, YouTube now. I've started doing that. So if you like listening to podcasts through YouTube, you can do that. And also there was another one, the website. The website you can also listen through on that. So make sure you subscribe on any of the platforms you prefer. Make sure you're telling your friends and family about the show. Get the word out. Get some more listeners. If you've tried to get people in the past and they were like, I don't have iTunes, we're now on Spotify and YouTube, so they can listen through there. What else have I got? If you're listening through iTunes, make sure you leave us a 5-star review. It helps us out with the rankings. You can also leave a tip for the show. Nina, if people are a subscriber... sorry?
That might be one of the tips.
Oh, be better.
Be better at the podcast.
Oh, well, I think we're doing okay. Nina, if people like the podcast and they like what the IPA does around the podcast, how can they become a member? How can they become a donor?
Well, just visit the website, ipadog.au, and click on join button or the donation button if you decided to donate. And starting as low as $22 per year, you can become the voice of freedom.
That was so much better than I did it last week. All right, let's go to that interview now. Okay, we now welcome on Brendan O'Neill, editor of Spiked, Britain's first online-only current affairs magazine, launched back in 2001. Also a good friend of the IPA, former guest here on a speaking tour. Brendan, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
A couple of weeks ago on Spiked, you wrote, there are new divides, new tensions, exciting tensions between populists and elitists, Democrats and technocrats, people who believe in the nation and people who despise the nation and the thing it contains in relation to Brexit, but also in general. So why do elites distrust the general public so much?
I think it's been gathering pace for quite a long time. There's just this growing distance, I think, between the political class and ordinary people. I think it's related to the collapse of the old left-right divide, you know, the emptying out of the old political system, the old political parties, shrinking memberships among many Western political parties, the growth of technocracy, where increasingly the political class outsources political decision-making to largely unaccountable bodies. This is most pronounced in Europe, where 27 countries have outsourced major forms of political decision-making to the European Union. And as a process of all those things, over a period of 4 or 5 decades, really, there's just this massive gap has opened up between the political elites and ordinary people, so that we end up in a situation like today, where they increasingly do not understand us. We increasingly do not understand them. And I think that's giving rise to a new form of tension, which in recent years, has really come to the surface and is now expressing itself in many different interesting ways.
So one of the things that struck me about that passage that you wrote, Brendan, was that you said that there were exciting tensions in this kind of distrust between these two groups. Why are these divides exciting? What kind of opportunities does this tension create?
I think they create huge opportunities. I think they create huge opportunities for calling into question the way in which politics is done right now. I think a lot of people feel increasingly irritated at the way in which politics is carried out. The fact that we're no longer really engaged with as political citizens, but more as kind of patients who have to have their health improved and be told how to eat and how to raise their children, you know, that rather hectoring, technocratic, nanny state approach that the distant political elite has taken in recent years. People are also annoyed about the fact that they feel they don't have any democratic clout, that, you know, what they think about mass immigration or what they think about multiculturalism and all these other supposedly controversial issues is no longer taken seriously, is no longer taken on board. I think people feel annoyed that there are certain things they are not allowed to say anymore. If you raise criticisms of radical Islam, you'll be called Islamophobic. If you raise criticisms of the process of immigration, you'll be called xenophobic. If you worry about the speed at which something like same-sex marriage was introduced, you'll be called homophobic. You know, all these insults that have been invented basically to shame and demonize ordinary people who have slightly different views to the political class. So people are irritated by all of that. And I think what we're witnessing now is a revolt against that kind of politics, where people are saying, well, we've had enough of this. I think the vote for Trump was a very interesting swipe against the old political establishment, as best embodied by Hillary Clinton. I think the vote for Brexit was a very clear rebellion against the new technocratic elitism. And across Europe, we are seeing the decay of the old parties, particularly the Social Democratic Party, and the rise of these new populist movements, which are basically saying, well, we are going to say the unsayable thing. We are going to raise these questions we're not meant to raise, and we're going to stir politics up. I think that's all very positive.
So when people voted for Brexit, and that was such an incredible vote, but it's been about 2 years and we still don't have an idea of like what form of Brexit it's going to take. The Chequers Agreement really went out with a thud. So if there isn't the elites coming back to the people and starting to talk with them, instead of talking at them, what's going to happen to British society in like 5, 10, 15 years from now if there's not moving back towards some sort of cohesion between the commoners and the elites?
I think that's a really good question, and it's a difficult one to answer because everything is so unpredictable now. The thing that worries me, and which worries a huge number of people in Britain, is that we had this vote for Brexit. It's the largest democratic vote in the entire history of Britain. 17.4 million people voted to leave the EU. That many people in Britain have never voted for anything before. So it was absolutely huge, historically huge. But of course, it went entirely against what the political establishment wanted. They were basically on their knees begging us to vote Remain, and we all voted Leave. So there has been this great tension over the past 2 years between a political elite that wants to stay in the EU and this massive, historically unprecedented block of people who want to leave the EU. So it's almost like a civil war atmosphere in Britain, thankfully, without any violence. So on the one hand, you have a political class which is doing everything within its power to weaken the demand for Brexit and to stay, either to stay in the EU completely or to stay in some EU institutions. And on the other side, you have ordinary people saying, but we want to leave, that's what we called for, and we don't want you to sell us out. So at the moment, it looks like Brexit, in its real meaningful sense of leaving all EU institutions, is not going to happen. And I think that will really call into question whether Britain is genuinely a democratic nation. And it will make people think, well, what's the point in voting anyway? What's the point in engaging with politics? Maybe there's a different way to do things. So I think what happens over the next 5 or 10 years will be very interesting. I think either there will be the spread of apathy and people will think, well, there's no point engaging because they don't listen to us. Or there could be something a bit more rebellious. There could be splits within the party. There could be the emergence of new movements. I'm hoping it will be the latter, because I think apathy will be the wrong response to the political class's selling out of Brexit.
So there's two things I want to unpack with that answer. First, you said Brexit in the form that the voters asked for probably won't happen. Is that you saying that there's going to be a very soft Brexit where they remain in the customs union? Or do you start to think that the calls for another vote might come through?
I think it could be... I think it's quite unlikely that there will be a second referendum. I think the call for a second referendum is entirely undemocratic. They present it as a democratic request because, you know, they want another vote. But my argument is if you have a second referendum before the demand of the first referendum has been properly enacted and institutionalized and made a part of British public life, then you are actually trying to overthrow democracy rather than to expand democracy. So to have a second referendum before the first referendum has been acted upon would be a disgrace, I think. It seems unlikely that will happen because I think it's so clear to people that that is an attempt to usurp the democratic vote that we had in June 2016. I think more likely we will get a deal that will be a very soft Brexit. Now, it's important to bear in mind that the terms soft Brexit and hard Brexit were entirely invented post-referendum. There was no discussion of soft and hard Brexit in the run-up to the referendum. Everybody understood that it was a very simple binary question. Should we stay in the EU or should we leave the EU? David Cameron and George Osborne, who were the Prime Minister and Chancellor at the time, made it clear again and again that leaving the EU would mean leaving the single market and other trade bodies. It's only after the referendum that the political class invent these new ideas that there's hard Brexit, which is really bad, and there's soft Brexit, which is preferable, which would mean staying in the customs union, maybe staying beholden to certain single market rules, certainly staying beholden to certain rulings of the European Court of Justice. And my point is that that's not Brexit, and it's really misleading to even refer to it as a soft Brexit because it is, in essence, Remain by another name, because we would stay beholden to institutions which, in various different ways, override our capacity to make democratic decisions.
One of the things we talk about here is this kind of rejection of democracy that you're talking about and rejection of the will of the people that you're talking about leads to this erosion of the egalitarian spirit of democracy. Do you think that's a problem or do you think that's happening? And do you think that's a problem if it is happening, or do you think that kind of disruption is actually an opportunity?
I think it's happening. There is a turn against democracy among the political class, the political establishment, and I find it incredibly worrying. I think the really interesting thing since the vote for Brexit 2 years ago is that not only has the political establishment been saying, oh, this was the wrong vote, you shouldn't have done this, this is terrible, you know, we knew they would say that, but what they've gone further and they've started to call into question the entire idea of asking ordinary people for their views on big political matters. So they have gone, not only have they said this was the wrong vote, you've really annoyed us, but we'll carry it out anyway. Instead, what they've done is said, well, maybe democracy was a mistake, and maybe people are too gullible and easily swayed and brainwashed by demagogues, and therefore they're not very reliable when it comes to making big constitutional decisions. So all the things that British people have been fighting for really since the English Civil War in the 1640s, which is the right of people to determine the fate of their nation, which is the right of people to have a say in what happens politically to the society they live in, all those things that we fought for in various different ways over 300 or 400 years are now being called into question by a very bruised, wounded, angry political establishment. I find that really worrying, because it suggests that their commitment to democracy was quite flimsy and it has been quite exposed that it was a very thin commitment and they've turned their backs on it very quickly. And secondly, because I think it does raise the question, well, then how do we make our voices heard? If making a vote and making your opinion clear and taking part in a referendum isn't enough to get your point of view across. Well, what can you do? What can we do? And so I think it's going to create a sense of tension, a desire perhaps for a different way of doing politics, and a belief among huge numbers of ordinary people that democracy is a sham. So it's opening up the door to all sorts of quite conflictual arguments, I think.
Cool. So we'll leave Brexit to the side for one moment, but I think we're starting to hit on a wider issue here, which is something we've been talking about on the podcast a fair bit, and that's the growing intolerance of, well, mainly the left to other ideas or ideas they don't seem suit to be palatable. So do you agree that the left is becoming more intolerant in, say, the last 5 or 10 years towards new ideas?
Yes, absolutely. I think you can see it everywhere from, you know, on campuses, through to social media witch hunts against people who have, you know, wrong think. You can see it in the demand for the expulsion of people like Alex Jones and InfoWars from YouTube and Facebook and so on. There's this growing desire to expel from public life or to expel from academic life anyone who is deemed to hold the incorrect opinion. So I think we are definitely witnessing the rise of a new intolerance. And I think it's really worrying to me how casually it seems to come to people, how naturally they seem to adopt this incredibly censorious, intolerant approach, and that they seem not to appreciate how important the battle for freedom of speech was over the past few centuries, and it, most importantly, how important it was to minority groups and oppressed groups who saw freedom of speech as the main means through which they might challenge their oppression, speak for themselves, make an impact on the world. What we have now is a complete reversal of that, where you have this new left which argues that the best thing for oppressed groups or minority groups is censorship, that what they need is protection, that they need to be protected from offensive ideas, they need to be protected from people who call into question aspects of their identity or their lifestyle. So I'm really particularly worried about how radical left-wing politics has shifted from a politics which used to be quite favorable to the idea of freedom of speech, particularly as a means of speaking out against the powerful, and which now is much more favourable towards censorship and calling upon the powerful to protect us from offensive ideas.
Yeah, that switch between free speech being the tool of the oppressed to now being seen as the tool of the oppressor, when did that actually happen? Because that's such a new concept.
Yes, I think it really... I mean, it's hard to pinpoint it exactly. I think, you know, the last time I think the left was quite favourable about freedom of speech was really in the 1960s when, you know, of course, there was the great free speech movement on West Coast campuses in the US, but across the Western world, there was a general sense of favourability among left-wingers for the right of people to be countercultural, to publish risque literature, to publish shocking magazines, and, you know, some left-wing or liberal, small L liberal people were involved in campaigns for the right to publish obscene content. And so, you know, really in the 60s and early 70s, people who would have described themselves as generally quite left-wing or quite radical were still favorable towards the idea that people should be able to say and depict and talk about and sing about anything that they wanted to. Then I think in the late 70s and then particularly in the 1980s with the growth of political correctness, we see a turn against that idea and this kind of embrace over time of this quite relativistic notion that words are harmful, that words can cause pain, that, you know, particularly for minority groups or for women and for homosexuals and so on, that, you know, words can be incredibly damaging and can, you know, batter their self-esteem and make people feel devalued. That idea takes hold really in the late 70s and throughout the 1980s, so that we now arrive in a world where free speech is seen, you know, I've seen people have said this to me when I do speeches on campus and so on, they say free speech is only good for, you know, white men. they love it because they can say whatever they want. But for, you know, for a Muslim woman or for a young gay man or for all these other people, free speech is a terrible thing because it means they can be abused and shouted at and demeaned and so on. So there's a whole new generation which genuinely sees freedom of speech as a very harmful thing. And I find that incredibly worrying because without freedom of speech, every other freedom becomes impossible. Democracy itself becomes more difficult. And the very ideals of civilized Western society are called into question. So I think it's so important that we try to convince people that freedom of speech is actually the most important value in a civilized society.
Actually, I'm glad you touched on that, Brendan, because I hate that argument that, you know, ethnic minorities or whatever the group might be can't participate in free speech. I just think it's so patronising. It might be worth touching on now. I'm not sure if all our listeners are aware that you used to be a Marxist, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong. Is this part of the reason why you moved from that part of politics to obviously a different part of politics now? How did that transition take place?
Well, see, I still consider myself quite left-wing. I know everyone always looks at me in a very confused way when I say that.
I think, after this interview, people might be thinking about that.
Yeah, but, you know, I think, you know, I was a libertarian Marxist, which I know lots of people think is a contradiction in terms. But actually, it is not a contradiction in terms, because if you go back to the original writings of Marx or the original writings of Engels, they were, you know, they had a real sense of, you know, the question of how can we expand the sovereignty of the individual or the right of people to have more control over their lives. You know, my favorite quote, which I made at an IPA talk in Australia a couple of years ago, is from Trotsky. And Trotsky said that the you know, a serious radical left-wing person, his greatest interest is in diminishing the power of man over man and expanding the power of man over nature. And so, see, that's my approach to politics. I want to diminish the power of man over man in the sense that I want less bureaucracy, less censorship, less welfareism when that interferes in people's decision-making, less political control of what people can say and do. But I want to expand the control of man over nature because I like the idea of exploration and progress and growth and development and creating a world through in which people have more stuff and more comfort and so on. So I still adhere to that Trotskyist view. I think the problem is that over time, the left has completely lost the plot, has shifted away from some of those old values, some of which were good, some of which were not good, and has become very, instead of having those kind of old libertarian tendencies, has now become very pro-state, very pro-censorship, very anti-people, now sees, it kind of distrusts ordinary people and thinks they need constant health advice and constant moral advice and constant guidance. And, you know, essentially they need to be saved from themselves. So I would say that the real problem is that the left has ditched its old principles and become this new, quite authoritarian, distrusting movement. So the dilemma I find myself in, and I know there are other people who feel similarly to me, is that we look at the left now and we just don't recognize it. We just say, this isn't what we signed up for. So I would say that I don't fall on the left or the right. I am one of those many people who feel quite politically homeless. And I think that's another reason I find the populist revolts taking place right now very interesting, because I think those are revolts of the politically homeless, where people are saying, well, the old conservative side of politics doesn't speak for me. The social democratic side of politics has let me down time and time again. So I'm going to try and find a new group or a new institution or a new idea that might express what I'm feeling. So I like, it's a revolt of the politically homeless, which I find very interesting.
So with the revolt of the politically homeless, now, when they're sort of rebelling against being told what to say by the political class, do you reckon the future for free speech in Britain is growing if there's so much of a public under-support for the spread of free speech?
I think it's the problem we have in Britain, as we have in many Western countries, is that The political establishment is just completely and utterly anti-free speech at the moment. So right in the short term, at least, the future for free speech looks incredibly bad. I mean, some of the examples here are genuinely shocking. I'm sure you guys have heard about the online shitposter, as they refer to themselves, who was recently arrested and convicted of being grossly offensive because he taught a dog to do a Nazi salute. We've had a recent incident where a young woman was arrested and convicted for being grossly offensive because she posted rap lyrics on her Instagram page, and the rap lyrics included the N-word. One of the most shocking incidents, I think, is that recently a woman was charged and convicted of being grossly offensive because she sang songs on YouTube in which she denied the Holocaust. Now, I, and I'm sure the vast majority of normal people, think Holocaust denial is a foul, racist ideology. But what's really interesting about that case is that Holocaust denial is not actually illegal in Britain. One good thing that we've refused to do is to adopt Holocaust denial laws. But she could still be charged because we have this act called the Communications Act, which was passed in 2003, which basically makes it a crime to be grossly offensive on the internet. So basically anyone who is judged to be grossly offensive, whether they are making a dog do a Nazi salute, whether they are telling an offensive joke, whether they are trolling a politician, whether they are denying the Holocaust, can now find themselves in court with a criminal conviction. So this is the situation we have in Britain. It's against the law in Britain to be grossly offensive. And if we are serious about freedom of speech, then it should never be against the law to be offensive, mildly offensive, a little bit offensive, horrendously offensive, grossly offensive. That should never be something that should fall under the remit of criminal law. So this is the direction Britain is going in at the moment, because we have a political establishment that is incredibly suspicious of freedom of speech and far prefers to control public life from the top. Among ordinary people, I think there is a far greater interest in having a more honest public sphere, in having honest, open, free discussions about the ideology of multiculturalism, the role of the European Union, all those kinds of things. So there's a conflict at the moment. There's a tension between a political elite that wants to censor everything and a huge number of ordinary people who think we need more debate, not less.
I would agree with that, and I'd say that amongst ordinary people, there's also a lot of young people which are very aware of freedom of speech issues. I know that you've had a debate cancelled due to student activism on a college campus or a university campus in Britain. We find with a lot of our work with Generation Liberty, with young people on campus, that there's a real appetite for genuine free speech and genuine exchange of ideas. What do you think? Do you think there is, amongst young people, hope for a better future for free speech, or do you think that they are just as censorious as anyone else?
Yeah, it's really interesting when it comes to young people and millennials, because on one hand, because they've been socialized in this new political climate, which encourages us to take offense and encourages us to feel weak and fragile all the time, and encourages us to value our own self-esteem above the right of other people to say whatever they want to say and to express whatever they think. Because they've been socialized into that climate, because they've grown up in that climate, some of them do express quite severely this new culture of censorship. So sometimes when I go on campuses, young people will say to me, you know, you can't say this, this is really shocking, this is offensive. I spoke at Oxford a couple of months ago, and there was a protest outside, people with placards saying, hate speech kills, get Brendan O'Neill off our campus. And they had this genuine belief that my words would hurt them, that my speech, which was on the relationship between heresy and progress and the fact that heresy is essential to scientific, technological and moral progress, they had a real genuine belief that my speech on that issue would cause them physical and mental harm. So they've really imbibed that idea that words can cause devastating harm to the individual. But the flip side of that, and the reason I still feel very optimistic, is that there are also large numbers of young people who don't buy into that and who feel irritated by this patronizing culture. And I also meet them on campuses. So they come to hear my talks or they ask to interview me for their newspapers. And I know that they feel insulted by this notion that they must be protected from difficult ideas or difficult speech. So that makes me feel very positive. I think among millennials in particular, there's a real tussle at the moment between one side which says words are harmful and we need censorship, and another side which says, you know, stop patronizing us and let us speak freely. And I think whatever we can do to cultivate that latter side, to cultivate those who believe freedom of speech is still an incredibly important value, would be really worth doing.
All right, we'll give Brendan one final question because we know he's got to get on with his day. I went to the Spike website and I saw in the About section the following passage. The golden age, which a blind tradition has always placed in the past, is really in front of us. Spiked is all about laying the ground for and Simon, who said, the enemies of that still to come golden age for humankind. And that's quite an optimistic note. You know, we've talked a lot about the problems with Britain and the world in this interview. Do you have optimism for the future of Britain and the idea that that enlightenment optimism can still invigorate people, invigorate public debate?
Yeah, I'm overall optimistic, which doesn't mean I think that progress and enlightenment and, you know, the golden age of the future is inevitable. I don't think we are naturally moving towards that. I don't believe in the kind of constant march of justice or progress. I think it's something people have to work at incredibly hard. But I think, you know, I'm inspired by Renaissance thinkers and Enlightenment thinkers and by some of the ideals of the French Revolution and the American Revolution and all these periods in history when people gathered together and said, well, let's radically change politics. And sometimes they did so, you know, in a matter of months, shifted from one political system to another, shifted from one way of thinking to another way of thinking. So the evidence of the past 400 or 500 years of, you know, in the supposed enlightened period, the evidence suggests that it is entirely possible to move society forward and to create a better society than the one that existed before. The problem we face right now, of course, is that the forces of reaction are quite powerful. And there are many illiberals around. There are many sections of the political and chattering classes who have backward ideas, who do not trust ordinary people, who are illiberal and unenlightened, and who are anti-progress and anti-growth. So I think we have our work cut out for us in terms of defeating their arguments and pushing forward more progressive arguments, but I think it's entirely possible and really worth pursuing.
All right, Brendan O'Neill, editor of Spikes. Go check it out. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you too, Brendan O'Neill, for that interview.
Awesome.
Really interesting chat. So yeah, go check out Spiked online if you guys haven't heard of it before, but hopefully you already have. Let us get into some stories that have made us laugh this week. And if I may start, this might get a little grandstanding, but if the keen-eyed listener from last week's show will... from last week's show might have remembered that Pete and I had a standing Mars bar bet.
We had a wager.
so they pay us in Mars bars here.
Yeah.
So the idea was whether or not Sarah Jeong, who got hired at the New York Times as a tech writer and then all the tweets about why people got bought up, Pete thought she'd be fired for them.
I did.
I thought the New York Times would absolutely in no way fire someone that was racist towards white people.
Yeah.
Turns out I was right. Sorry. Here is the Mars bar.
There it is.
Here is it unwrapping. And
oh,
my God.
I got the small one because I know James is trying to get beach ready. And
personality season is over. Yeah, did you see this one, though, but about the Sarah Jeong fix? So,
yeah.
Brett Stevens, like the New York Times token conservative columnist, wrote a column say like welcoming Sarah Jeong to the New York Times. And then another writer, Elizabeth Williamson, tweeted out, here's Brett Stevens offering a classy welcome to a colleague who has yet to prove she deserves one. And then she had to delete her tweet and apologize to Sarah Jeong.
that's how
bad things are at the New York Times right now. Like, apologize to that woman for criticizing her racist tweets. Apologize right now.
I will never back the New York Times to make a good decision again.
No. I'm going to put that away from me. I'm that Mars bar is not long for this world. I'll tell you that much for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I just assume they would. I should have, like any good person who makes stupid bets with their mates, I should have left in a clause and not said by next show.
Yeah.
Because then I could still claim, well, you know, she might be sacked.
No, I think the larger one is never expect anyone to do the right thing, especially the New York Times. Like, the right thing would have been to get rid of her. Well, probably not.
Never expect anyone to do the right thing.
No, never expect anyone.
Come on, this is an optimistic podcast.
Well, yeah, optimistic about this podcast, not the world that it stands above. I don't know, went down a path there. Okay, so I'll move on to another story. So ABC Life launched recently, I think this week. So ABC Life is ABC's solution to BuzzFeed. So they have just got a bunch of articles. There doesn't seem to be a news slant. It's more of a lifestyle kind of thing.
Oh, great.
Cost $8 million to make. I'm just going to read you guys a few of the headlines.
Excellent.
So we've got here, is clocking off at 5 p.m. still killing your shot at that promotion? Probably.
I don't think that's the problem. The
one word answer. Yeah. Is dating someone with debt a deal breaker? Is dating someone with debt a deal breaker?
Hope not.
Yeah. That's an article. I've got one here. Death isn't weird. Sitting with someone who is dying. Death is weird, by the way. It's very strange. And like otherwise, you know. A helpful duck and Costa channels Chance the Rapper. So huge website.
Yeah.
$8 million to make. And I just want to reiterate what Gavin Morris said at the time of the budget. There is no more fat to cut in the ABC. Any more cuts of the ABC cut into the muscle of the organization.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, James, because there is only muscle that we're cutting into now.
Yeah, that is the muscle of the muscle. Candlesticks, trophies, and mugs. Why I won't be putting off death cleaning. What's the death at the ABC Life?
Well, I was going to raise...
It's ABC Life.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all these articles about death. Anyway.
I was going to raise about this, like as if you'd be receiving life advice from the sad sacks at the ABC.
Oh, could you imagine?
Like, half of these people, are they even alive or just reanimated corpses? And I've been proven right by all these bloody headlines.
Yeah, well, it's a way to, like, maybe they'll tell you the secret to a second life in that you come back from the dead and you're suddenly presenting an ABC show. So, yeah, you know, maybe they've got something to say.
And the other thought that struck me, James, was that we should release, and Nina, we should release our own lifestyle website.
Oh, I know.
Because I have a lot to give.
Yeah, how to watch sport on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, exactly. You know, beyond the sort of, you know, political chat we do on the podcast, I have a lot of things I'd like to share. Anyway, it's in the works. All right, free library. So this...
Still looking for initial funding on that website, so hit us up.
Yep. We should be able to do it for $8 million, maybe $7 million at a stretch. All right, so this mailbox library thing, people might have seen the mailbox library thing. It's actually a really cool phenomenon around the world where people are putting out mailboxes with library books in them, and everyone's allowed to take a book.
Yeah, just from their house, like their mailbox at their house.
Yeah, at their house. There's actually one in Brunny. It's got heaps of Naomi Klein in it, I think, and the Communist Manifesto, but there is one in Brunswick.
That does not surprise me. That's the most Brunswick thing I've ever heard in my life.
But at least, you know, it's free. Anyway, so...
That's not Brunswick. That's very expensive.
A family in New Jersey had one of these things, and they got a visit from the police because it was too high.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the height of the mailbox for mailbox libraries have to be below 2.5 feet. This one was above 2.5 feet. Or 10 feet from the property line.
Yeah.
So this
would be absolute chaos.
Or there'd be pandemonium. So this one was higher than 2.5 feet, but closer than 10 feet to the property line. So unfortunately, they've had to move it or make it shorter. But this was brought on by someone, a snitch, grassing them up.
Yeah, can I just, I'll just add here. The police visited them on the same day as the grand opening. Yeah. Like, this was like a same day thing.
This was lightning operation.
Yeah, the police force at its finest.
So,
it's inside a job then.
Yeah, well.
Well, yeah.
Oh, no, I thought about it.
So it's like the dad going, like, I handle all these kids around my house.
Yeah, they say.
Yeah, like.
And they say conspiracy theories took a backseat when Alex Jones went off the air.
We've got a new one.
Is filling the void.
Nina's going to take the throne.
Ha ha.
Anyway, I had one more thing that I wanted to mention about this. Point Pleasant Borough Administrator Frank Panucci had this quote. So that's the council that's in charge of doing the thing in New Jersey. He said, there's nothing wrong with the library itself, but you can't have the little free library there because you're going to have kids walking down the street. It's causing a hazard. Kids walking down the street causing a hazard.
Yep.
With the library.
Kids on the street with books are Are you serious, Frank Panucci?
We can't have kids reading. I also want to have a quote from this one. So Grace Hagemeyer is the woman who set up the library with her husband. So she had the quote here, police should not be knocking on people's doors because they want to give away books. Very reasonable.
Grace nailed it.
Grace for the police person.
Yep.
That's what I'm saying. Cool. Got another one here. Sorry, Tim Sudamasan, old friend of the podcast.
Massive.
Boy, are we going to miss him when he goes. He's in his last speech in his position.
Finally.
Tim Sudamasan has accused section of the media of, quote, monetizing racism to hold on to their audiences. With another quote here. Right now, it feels like there has never been a more exciting time to be a dog-whistling politician or race-baiting commentator in Australia. If anyone would know.
I didn't.
If anyone would
like
know.
Literally what everyone was thinking.
Yeah,
hey, that's a bit rich, Tim.
Yeah. So, well, no, I think it's to say, look, if you want to get out there and say there's racism everywhere, now's the time to do it. Mate, it is financially, but
well, there's a $300,000 job available. And the other thing I was going to say about this is, of course, I thought this guy's retired like 3 months ago when he's doing the John Farnham retirement tour.
Never ends.
Anyway, farewell, Tim.
Yeah, can't wait for him to run for parliament.
It's been great.
Yeah, absolutely. So let us move on to... I've got one more story, Pete.
Yeah, go. So, push on.
We talked about Brexit with Brendan O'Neill. Another Brexit story that's popped up. So Andy Party is driving 30,000 kilometres on a trip he's dubbed the last European tour to send a message to politicians and the public back home to stop Brexit. So he's put up a map of his road trip, and he is basically driving around so that from a satellite image of his road trip, you can figure out the word stop Brexit. So he's drawn an S through driving through Britain, a top through driving through Scandinavia, and then Brexit through mainland Europe. Now, have you ever heard something so clearly define itself between, so clearly put the chasm between the public and the elites than a man who has the time and disposable income to drive stop Brexit around Europe to stop Brexit?
Having
like, no one's saying leave Brexit. No one's got the time to do that one.
No, no, they're at work.
They're at work.
That's quite impressive. I've seen this image of where he's driving.
Yeah, it is huge. So I want to say it looks like a sick road trip. Like, I would do the stop Brexit road trip any day. You see every European country, except Italy from the looks of it. Yeah, it looks like fun.
Is he in a car or a bike?
He is in a white van.
What,
really? So he hates
the environment.
So that's a picture of the route.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Not the emissions or anything.
No, not the emissions are going to be. Yeah. That's a good point. So don't, like, you know, Greenpeace, that polar, National Geographic, photograph that polar bear again, because by the time Andy Party's done his road trip, that is going to be one hungry polar bear.
But that white van thing's a real cultural thing in England.
Yeah.
They always talk about the man in the white van as like racist, stupid working class people.
As we're about to. Well, not about the racist, stupid working class people, but we are talking about the concept of white vans.
That is certainly a man in a white van. Like, he's literally in a white van. Roofer Stuart Gosling, 43, from London. Oh, I think he's just outside London. He was driving in East London and he got stopped by council workers doing spot checks. For what? I don't know. Well, I do know, because they found him in his van was a garbage bag full of rubbish, you know, like chip packets, sandwich wrappers, stuff like that, which he'd been putting there as he'd been eating his lunch. Got fined £300, which is about $4 million, because he didn't have a waste carrier's license. So to have rubbish in your van, you need a license in England.
I just want to say on this one, shout out to my friend Delwyn, occasionally listens to the show. You are on notice. The amount of rubbish that guy has in his car when I take trips with him.
I wouldn't.
Yeah. Do not drive in East London.
I would be in trouble.
You would be in trouble.
Unless you've got a commercial.
I'd apply for the license now.
Yeah, so I'm sure Stuart would have voted for Brexit. Yep. And I'm sure he would have had a St. George's cross hanging out of his car during the World Cup.
Yeah.
And I would like to point out that the murder rate in London last year rose 44%.
Yep.
So it's good to see the government has its priorities
cracking
in order.
Cracking down on people carrying plastic bags in the sealed container that is their car.
Unbelievable.
Cool. That is it for the show this week. So thank you to Brendan O'Neill for those interviews. And make sure you download Great Books coming out on Tuesday. That's going to be a cracking podcast. So thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for subscribing. Available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, our website, and YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to any platform you want. Make sure you're telling your friends and family about it and where they can download it. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you leave us a 5-star review. Mm-hmm. Nina, let's talk membership.
Yeah, if you are wanting to become a member of the IPA and love what our works anyway, just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button. And you starting as low as $22, you can become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
Fantastic. See you guys next week.
See ya.